are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 5th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of Middle Eastern Studies in the History Department at the University of Michigan, Juan Cole, on his book, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace and the Clash, Amidst the Clash of Empires. Also on the program today, it is a day of national mourning when we recall the suffering of those killed and injured in the first Iraq War and throughout Central America as former CIA chief and president George Herbert Walker Bush finally laid to rest. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn has sung, and apparently it was an incredibly long and beautiful tune about three different investigations over the course of 19 recitals. The Trump administration wants to eliminate the U.S. Postal Service workers' rights to negotiate for their pay. Wisconsin Republicans pass a host of undemocratic laws in the middle of the night. And the Weekly Standard is on its last legs as conservatism looks into the mirror and sees Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's EPA to roll back limits on coal plants. And the Senate is now firmly turning on Mohammed bin Salman after a PowerPoint by the CIA. National Republican Congressional Committee emails were hacked, unreleased. The Republican sadly wins the Secretary of State race in Georgia. Jeffrey Epstein, convicted sex offender, settles a suit, but more coming. And AOC looking to get on the Ways and Means Committee in the House. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Wednesday, it is, a national holiday of sorts. Federal offices are closed. The stock exchange is closed. I think they're probably happy about that. Yesterday, I think it took a big tumble. I only am aware of that peripherally, as I am not heavily invested in the stock market.
Just a couple of oil companies.
Big tobacco.
Yep.
Weapons manufacturers.
Yeah, Lockheed just had a huge merger approved.
Yes, I'm very excited about that.
CEW and Tobacco Energy Weapons.
There you go.
Safe portfolio.
That's my portfolio, of course. Heavily invested in those sectors. Most of that is just actually delivered in cash bags, slush fund. Yeah, so. Today is a day of mourning for George Herbert Walker Bush. Like I said yesterday, perhaps one of the more overrated presidents that we had. This is a guy who pardoned three, four, maybe more people involved in the Iran-Contra scandal to probably protect his own culpability.
Mm.
He waged a war against Saddam Hussein after basically either purposely or mistakenly opening the door to Saddam Hussein's attack on Kuwait. He encouraged the Shia in Iraq to rise up and then did not offer them any support, therefore leading to mass slaughter. He also, of course, was instrumental in bringing some of those Phoenix program folks from Vietnam over into Central America as the CIA chief, and the implications of which we see reverberate to this day in terms of the massive violence and breakdown in societal structures in many countries in Central America. I mean, it's not inconceivable that he was one of the midwives of the crack epidemic we had back in the 80s as the CIA was using cocaine as a means in which to finance some of their illicit activities. I mean, there's a whole host of issues as to why we should remember this man on this day.
Yeah, but he was polite to other politicians, so he was better than Trump.
He was incredibly polite and very patrician and also extremely, extremely wealthy, which, of course, is, well, not that rare for a president. But here we have Donald Trump very appropriately heading to the funeral today. Let's take a look at the video. This is the video of Donald Trump heading to the by motorcade to the Blair House, the presidential guest house across Pennsylvania Avenue, to visit with the family of President, the late President George Herbert Walker Bush. Let's play the video because it lasts only seconds because he gets into a motorcade. Can we expand that? Let's take a look at this video. Here it is. There he goes. And it's quite a motorcade. And then they stop right there. That's a nice, easy means in which to shoot that because you just have to pivot your body about 15 degrees to capture. It was about here. Let's take a look at the map. This is let's say they say, OK, now, according to Google Maps, from the White House to the Blair House is approximately a 2 minute walk.
Walking sucks.
Yeah.
Overrated.
It's actually a 9 minute car ride. But it is a 2 minute walk.
I have to conserve my energy.
But I don't know that Donald Trump has walked for 2 minutes straight.
He might have a walking phobia.
It's possible.
He's afraid of stairs.
Too many curbs. Too many
curbs.
Can't do
it.
How long till he gets one of those motorized scooters for places that cars can't go?
I would not be surprised if that comes out in some White House memoir that that's what he's been using inside the White House.
Maybe like those motorized stair climbers for the elderly.
But
little chairs.
Indeed. And as George Herbert Walker Bush was an oil man, I guess he would appreciate the probably gallons of gas that were used in the multiple vehicles.
Fuel, opening up some markets.
There you go.
Appreciate what you did.
That's not to mention he replaced Thurgood Marshall. Do you know that? With
yes, with, I don't know who he replaced him with, but I know
with
that,
what's his face?
That creep.
Thomas. Oh,
yep.
Right. I found one.
Hey, exactly. He gots it, folks. One of today's sponsors is Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority, that's skl.sh/majority, and you guys got to wait at least until like this afternoon, because you're going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community. It offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, mediation, everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that's going to be useful for you both in your personal and professional life. I am a perfect example of that. Let me read this and I'll just tell you in a second. Wait, whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing or you want to learn how to do something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They got courses for entrepreneurs on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, brushing up on your Spanish, Photoshop, you name it. For instance, I don't know why I did this. I don't cut that much stuff, but I was sort of just interested in it. I watched this like mini class on knife skills, like on how to chop like a chef. And I also took one on Google Analytics because I thought like I should understand that stuff. And I know it a little better, but I'm glad I'm not going to take another one. I just don't. That's too dry for me. But both were incredibly informative. And I'm going to be doing, taking more, frankly. There's one on just brewing an amazing cup of coffee. But there's also stuff like accounting. You can take accounting classes. You can learn all accounting skills in 1 hour. I think that's actually one I'm going to just set up to do because I need to do that. But you can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majority. That's skl.sh/majority. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. skl.sh/majority. I put a link in our podcast description and of course under our YouTube at the moment. So check that out. Also, remember, this holiday season is a great time for a bedding upgrade for you or frankly for somebody else. I've sent Brooklinen sheets to my sister as a gift last year. Maybe I'll do the other sister this year. She's probably listening. I just blew it. Brooklinen works directly with manufacturers and customers. They're able to offer a 5-star hotel quality sheets that are affordable and easy to order. Plus, they have over 20 colors and patterns. These sheets don't just feel amazing. They look great, too. And they're super fast shipping. Make sure you get them for holiday gifts and you get it on time. I have 3-4 different sets of Brooklinen sheets now. I keep ordering more. I'm now like getting a little bit fanatical about getting more pillowcases because I'm trying to mix and match striped and solids with the pillowcases. I'm getting very excited about that. You get three. There's 3 different versions of the sheets. Personally, I go for the cool, crisp cotton ones, but they have like the smoother ones. I don't like those. I like the cool, crisp sleep. But my Brooklinen sheets are the best. They're the most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. And now it's time for your upgrade. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer for just Majority Report listeners. You get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com, promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these really are the best sheets ever. And lastly, this is super cool. Our last sponsor of the day is Privacy.com. And you can check them out at privacy.com/majority. It is a totally free service. Go to privacy.com/majority that lets you buy anything online without having to give your credit card number and lets you prevent companies from overcharging you. Anybody in the office yesterday will know that that was a problem for me just as of yesterday. Here's how it works. You take a couple of minutes. You link your bank account to privacy.com. Then you're able to create virtual credit card numbers, which are linked to your bank account. You can create as many virtual cards as you want. You can delete them. You can freeze them and unfreeze them. You can set limits on each card. It's basically like a cloaking device for your credit card. It's great for signing up for free trials because you can just create a virtual card once and delete it, knowing that you'll never be charged once the trial is over. Think about it. How many times have you gone to do those free trials? You got to put your credit card in. You're like, I'm not going to do it because I'll forget and they'll charge me. It also protects you when companies get hacked and people's information is stolen because you're not giving out your real credit card number. Each card is locked to a merchant, so you're totally protected against fraud and unauthorized use of your card. Privacy.com's mobile app and desktop browser extension make it incredibly easy for you to manage your wallet of virtual cards and allow you to autofill your virtual card number at the click of a button when you're shopping online. There are countless different advantages to using a service like this to pay your bills and buy things online. You can find out more and get 100% free and unlimited access by going to privacy.com/majority. Again, we have links in our podcast description and in our YouTube page. Check it out, privacy.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to the great Juan Cole about his new book, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. We'll be right back.
Tell me everything you know about consciousness. Talk about half time, like we haven't seen the world all around your eyes.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Middle Eastern Studies in the History Department at the University of Michigan and author of his latest, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. Professor Juan Cole, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Sam.
So let's start. I want to resist the temptation of sort of applying what you have researched about Muhammad and Islam to today's sort of political scenes, but I want to hold off on that because I know this is a book that it's a history book. But let's just talk about the era in which Muhammad arises and the geopolitical context in which he begins the Muslim religion.
There was something that I call a world war going on, raging all around him and his people there in Western Arabia, between the Eastern Roman Empire and the Sasanian Empire in Iran. It began in 603 when Iran invaded the Eastern Roman Empire. And, you know, the Roman Empire at one point had the entire Mediterranean. But it had lost the West, and funnily enough, Rome, and moved to Constantinople, what is now Istanbul, in the East. But it ruled, you know, it had ruled Syria and what is now Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Egypt. And the Iranians took the Middle Eastern part of the Roman Empire away in that period after 603. And that was what was going on during the time that the Prophet Muhammad began preaching.
And so, give us a sense of, to the extent that I can understand and conceptualize these things, it's from having studied, what would be considered antiquity or somewhere between late antiquity around Yavne, and it's sort of the birth of sort of what we consider more modern Judaism today. rabbinic Judaism. And,
right.
And there was so many different sort of competing forces at that time. What were the competing forces that a prophet at that time would have found him or herself, I guess, surrounded by?
Sure. Well, culturally and religiously, the dominant force in the Roman Empire was Christianity. But it had a big schism, a big division between the imperial faith, which was favored in Constantinople in the late 500s and early 600s, which was called the Chalcedonian branch of the religion, after a conference that was held. And then locally you had what are called Miaphysites, or sometimes they're called Monophysites. And these two sort of branches of Christianity had severe how to define Jesus, his divinity, his relationship to God the Father, and so forth. And so they fought over this. And most people in Syria and Egypt favored the Miaphysite definition, whereas the imperial authorities favored the Chalcedonian. So the Christians were deeply divided, and the imperial faith had difficulty asserting itself in the Near East. And then on the Iranian side, the great religion of the time was the Zoroastrian faith, which is now a very small group of people, mainly in Bombay, in India. But at that time, it was a world religion and very influential, and believed in a prophet and a supreme deity and a kind of moral and ethical struggle against the forces of darkness. And then, as you say, there was a big Jewish community, not only in what is now Palestine and Israel, where there was a very large community still in the Galilee and Tiberias. They weren't allowed inside Jerusalem, by the way, by the Roman Christians. And then there was also a big Jewish community in Yemen, which had actually come to power briefly in the early 500s and then was dethroned by Christians. And there was wrangling between Christians and Jews in Yemen. And so the Prophet Muhammad lived in this multicultural world where there were various kinds of Christians, there were Jews, there were Zoroastrians, and they mostly didn't think well of one another. The two branches of Christianity called each other heretics and doomed each other to hell, and the Zoroastrians thought non-Iranians were barbarians, and so on and so forth. And my argument is that the Prophet Muhammad tried to create more of an ecumenical cultural stream there in that world.
And okay, yeah. So let's talk about the Prophet Muhammad as a prophet of peace. I mean, what does that mean exactly?
Well, there are many dimensions to his peace work. The first thing to say is that, you know, his career fell into two broad eras. One was when he began preaching in his hometown of Mecca in Western Arabia, and much of the Quran and the more, you know, shorter and medium chapters are from that time. And then a later period when he had and his followers were forced by persecution to emigrate to nearby Medina. And though the emphases in the Quran in those two eras are very different, but in the Mecca period, where they were simply being harassed and taunted by the Meccan power elite, which was still pagan. Most people in that world had either become Christian or Zoroastrian or Jews, but there were still some people who followed the old religion. And the old gods of the Arabs, or even, you know, the Olympian pantheon, people still worship Zeus and Athena and so forth. And the Arabs probably mixed the Greek and the Arab deities together. You know, polytheism is very hybrid. But they were very attached still in Mecca, according to the Quran, to their gods and goddesses. And the prophet preached monotheism, so his early community received a lot of harassment, The Quran consistently throughout this period advises people to deal with harassment by what we would think of as turning the other cheek. It says, repel evil with good, return taunting and harassment with wishes of peace, and say peace to those who are harassing you. And there's something very Sermon on the Mount-like about many of these verses in the Mecca period. Moreover, there's a kind of insistence on religious tolerance. So the Quran says to the pagans, you have your religion and we have ours. And it seems to imply that they should try to get along regardless of theological differences. The Quran in this period praises Jews as the chosen people, says that there are people among the Jews who are exemplars, teaching us all how to be better human beings. It praises the Christians for their own sense of charity, of giving to the poor, of turning the other cheek when faced with harassment. It's a very copacetic atmosphere that the Quran seems to present there in that period. Although it is admitting that there are these moments of harassment and taunting, they don't seem to rise to the level of violence, and that's different in the succeeding Medina period.
All right, I want to move to that Medina period in a moment, and get a sense of just how long, I guess, a period of time the Quran was essentially work in progress, To what extent is Islam at that point seen as a culmination of Judaism and Christianity, as part of a lineage as opposed to sort of like a rival?
Right. Well, it's been argued by Fred Donner at the University of Chicago that when Islam began there in Mecca, that it really was an ecumenical movement, and that people gathered around the leadership, the spiritual leadership of Muhammad, regardless of their religion, and that they could kind of be his followers and think well of his teachings and yet remain in their religion. And so that early Islam was kind of a United Nations of religions. And that's very plausible from what the Quran says, because it does praise these members of the other communities. And there's a document that survives when Muhammad goes to Medina, which explicitly says that the Muslims and the Jews are one nation. And it says the Muslims have their religion and the Jews have theirs. So it's possible to be part of this community or nation and yet retain a different faith.
And that's the is that the Constitution of Medina?
Yes, that's the Constitution of Medina.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, what are the implications of that? I guess that's part of the peace, right? I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, diplomacy going on here.
That's right. Well, from 610 to 622, the Prophet was preaching in Mecca, and then 622, the date of the emigration, they moved under pressure to Medina. And Medina was, from what the Quran says, a much more complex society, a bigger city and a more diverse one than had been Mecca. And there was a substantial Jewish community there, which the Prophet reached out to and tried to make an alliance with them and with the tribes in Medina, some of them probably still pagans. So he put together this coalition, and it was designed to protect Medina because it was clear that the Meccan pagans were angry and were going to come after them there, that Medina would be attacked. And so I think the Treaty of Medina or the Constitution of Medina was intended to bind together the major populations in the city in a defensive pact. But it does explicitly give a freedom of conscience to the Jewish inhabitants and makes them treaty partners with the believers.
So let's talk just briefly about the development of the Quran. How long is this sort of a work in progress? And then I want to just sort of like slowly get into this concept of abrogation.
Yes. Well, the prophet heard these words in his mind. The Quran talks about it as coming unbidden into his mind between 610 and 632. It was a couple decades and a half in progress. The character of the book changes a bit over time. The beginning chapters are short and kind of staccato, and then the middle chapters are more like the Psalms, you know, very sonorous and praises of God and so forth. And then the later chapters are more like Deuteronomy as they start talking about law and how to organize the society and so forth.
And okay, so I mean, developing in his mind, or was he writing it down and sort of like serializing it? Like, what was the actual mechanics of this?
Well, we don't know the answer to that question for sure. With the Quran, as I said, the prophet felt it as something coming to him externally. It wasn't like he sat down and wrote a book. It was more like inspiration. And then he would recite it to his followers. And the Muslim sources say that there were people who then memorized it. And other sources say that some people wrote it down, you know, and made inscriptions on camel bone shoulder blades and so forth. But we're now finding really early manuscripts. There's one dated as early as 645. The prophet died in 632. So it's entirely possible that there were Quran manuscripts on papyrus or parchment during the prophet's lifetime. The later sources just are murky and contradictory on how exactly all this happened.
And who would have written it down? I mean, I guess there. We have a sense that at least you know parts of the Christian Bible, right, were written by apostles and some, apostles of apostles, I guess. I mean, who would have written it down at that time? Dynamic or?
Actually, I would argue it's a different dynamic because in Christianity.
Oh, I'm sorry. Professor, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We just had a little bit. Our Skype is acting a little bit funky. I'm sorry. You were about to say it's a different dynamic than in Christianity.
Yeah, I think the Bible and the Quran or the New Testament and the Quran have a different kind of text history because. We think that the Gospels developed in Christian communities, and they were stories that those particular cities or communities told about Jesus, and they developed over time and ultimately got written down. Whereas it seems increasingly clear that the Quran is more like the letters of Paul they came through a particular person and in a particular era so they're not the work of a community some early sources say that there were scribes around the Prophet Muhammad the writers of the Revelation who took down the Quran. And others suggest that they just they had very powerful memories being tribal people, and they memorized large amounts of epic poetry so that they just memorized the Quran, and then a subsequent generation wrote it down. So as I said, this question you're asking is a really good one, and scholars puzzle over it, but it's also not been fully decided. And as I said, we're now starting to get some manuscript evidence for how these things happened, which seems to contradict some of the stories that that were told in later generations.
What of the legend, I guess, or the narrative of Muhammad being illiterate? Does that track with what what you've found or theorize?
Oh, no. I think it's very clear that Muhammad was not illiterate. First of all, he is said both by the early Muslim and the early Christian sources to have been a long-distance merchant. Long-distance merchants are always literate. How would you keep your books? And then the Quran as a document is just enormously learned and humane and broad, and it quotes the Palestinian Talmud. It has Aramaic words in it. It occasionally quotes the Bible. It retells in Judaism you have this tradition of the rabbis retelling the biblical stories with a particular moral point. It's called a midrash, and there are things like that in the Quran. So Muhammad was clearly a man who was, it seems to me, widely traveled, widely read. I suspect he was trilingual in Arabic, Aramaic, and Greek. I think it does a disservice to him to suggest that he was illiterate. And I think one of the reasons that the Muslim tradition sometimes asserts this is that they wanted to protect him from charges that he was a plagiarist, that he just picked these things up and reworked them from other people. But that kind of polemical charge is anyway silly, because that was his heritage. He was a man of the Near East, and of course he would in communicating to his audiences who knew these biblical or other stories, he would retell them with a moral point. And the Bible does the same thing. Some of what Jesus said is a retelling of Isaiah with a moral point. So I don't think it's necessary to have that point of view of Muhammad being illiterate in order to protect him from influences.
I mean, how do we know that all of that is a reflection of him as opposed to the crew around him that first transcribed stuff? Transcription manuscript, and maybe that window starts to close a little bit, but it's 10 years, a little bit more after he passes. How do we know he didn't just have sort of, lieutenants around who were like, we're going to definitely make this guy seem, a little bit more sophisticated?
Well, that's a really good question, Sam. And, you're managing to, through your questions, to raise these issues that have really dominated the study of early Islam for the last 40 years. There's a whole school called the revisionists who took the position that you just elaborated, which was that maybe the Quran is more like the Gospels, and that it grew up over time and was added to, and that reworked and maybe represents in some verses, more the atmosphere of the later Muslim empire in Damascus or Baghdad. And that revisionist school, however, I think has been pretty firmly refuted by now, for the most part. First of all, the Quran doesn't contain any evidence of any incident that happened after the Prophet Muhammad. So just to give one example, I read the Quran as being extremely pro-Roman. It predicts that the Romans, although they have been temporarily defeated, will come back. It talks about how the closest in love to the Muslims are the Christians. It talks about the need to protect churches from being raided and destroyed. So I see the book throughout, even into the late, what we think of are the later chapters, as pro-Christian, pro-Roman. We know that soon after the Prophet's death, however, the early Muslim polity based in Medina came into conflict with the Romans. So if some of the Quran were reworked after the Prophet's death, it surely would reflect that new situation of conflict with the Romans, and it doesn't. Whereas the later Muslim sources do. So there are many reasons for thinking that this document is 610, 632, and that it probably is, you know, something that came through the Prophet Muhammad himself.
So, okay, so great. All right, so but let's talk about that concept of abrogation now. What does that mean, and what is it in practice?
Right. Well, you know, it began as a way of dealing with the fact that the Quran did, you know, develop over time. Just to give you one example, there's an early verse that says, don't come to prayers drunk. So that seems to indicate that people were drinking alcohol, and sometimes they went a little too far. And that's disapproved of if you come to prayers drunk. But then there's a later verse that says, well, you know, in alcohol and gambling, there's good and bad. The bad outweighs the good towards disapproval. And then ultimately it says, don't drink. And so the people who were dealing with the Quran as a source of law, and by the way, there isn't very much law in the Quran, but the who were interested in this issue of Quranic law, wanted to be careful, you know, where you took the law from should be the most advanced position the Quran had. It shouldn't be an earlier position that later was changed. Likewise with the point of prayer, Muslims pray towards a particular point just as Jews do. And initially the Muslims prayed towards Jerusalem just as Jews do. But then around 624, the Quran instructs them to start praying towards Mecca instead. So, you know, if you were setting the point of prayer, you can't use the early verses, which seem to point towards Jerusalem. So there's abrogation in that sense, but it was initially always about, and the great jurists say it's only about law, and there isn't very much law in the Quran. Later on, a medieval Muslim started using it, I think, to shape their reception of the Quran in the ways that they wanted. So, as you had the Crusades or very military kind of movements, they started saying, well, all those peace verses I was talking about have been abrogated by the verses that talk about war, which a lot of the jurists thought was, you know, completely irresponsible and unacceptable. But there were people who did that. And so, you know, it was a way for the government or jurists to take control of the Quran instead of having it dictate their values. They could decide which parts of it they liked.
All right. I mean, this is, you know, that dynamic is, I think, hugely important. And it's obviously, that dynamic is not exclusive to the Quran. I mean, right. I mean, we see it in the context of the U.S. Constitution on some level as well, you know, considering the amount of time that we've had to sort of reinterpret the Constitution. We see the Supreme Court do it all the time. That concept is not unique. And on some level, it's that dynamic which we see, which takes us sort of like into the political realm of today, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the extremist groups disregard all of the commands in the Quran to make nice with other religions, to protect churches and synagogues, to reach out and be charitable towards other people, and then to wish peace upon your enemies. They disregard all those things because in the Medina period, when Medina was under attack from the militant pagans who came out with brigades and swords and spears, and they were going to kill the Muslims, the Quran then does permit defensive war, always defensive war, never offensive, but it does allow and indeed commands defensive war. And the verses where it says, you know, establish lookouts for the approach of the enemy, and then when you encounter them on the battlefield, meet them with deadly force, those kinds of verses, which are about those defensive encounters, then are misinterpreted by the extremists and also by people who hate Islam, by the way, as being somehow universal commandments, as having no context, and as outweighing all of the peace verses.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about that. I also have to say, in my for my own self-esteem, that I was very disciplined in not making this entire interview about your piece entitled "On How Everything Sam Harris Says About Islam Is Wrong." But let's talk about the modern day Islamophobia that we see, and the dynamic of I guess how there is this sort of like in this abrogation that goes on, but also B, there is a sort of lack of historical context in which people are assessing what certain Muslim people do without a historical context in which that that vision of Islam is being used. I mean, expand on what I've said and make it a little more clear, I guess, for folks.
Well, you've made it very clear. The fact is that first of all, often the Quran is not very well translated, people then don't know anything about its context. At one point Jesus says, "I haven't come to bring peace, I've come to bring a sword." And if people who didn't like Christianity could quote that and say, "Look, those Christians are about murdering people." That's the kind of thing that people do to the Quran and to Muslims. The Quran talks about the pagan, militant pagans who were trying to kill the Muslims as infidels. It never uses that word as a noun, poor Jews or Christians. And then it says that when those pagans come for you, defend yourself with lethal force if you have to. So then people will read that, and it says, slay the infidels. So then they allege that the Muslims want to go around just killing random people, which is, completely ahistorical and not what the Quran or the Muslim community believes at all. People like Sam Harris, who've made careers out of spreading hate against Muslims, have excerpted poorly translated versions of those verses and tried to make them mean something that they don't.
And one of the things that I think Sam Harris also likes to quote and to in his argument that there's something fundamentally wrong with Islam is the Hadith. What is the Hadith? What is the relationship of the Hadith to the Quran? And what of that practice of someone like Sam Harris's?
Yes, well, that's a complicated issue because mainstream Sunni Islam is a little bit like Orthodox Judaism in the sense that you have the Bible and then you had the Talmud, both are adhered to as strictly as possible. So with the Muslims, there's a big amount of material that grew up after the Prophet's death, which is sayings and doings which are attributed to him by later generations. Those were collected, and people tried to winnow through them and decide which ones were sound. But there's a vast amount of material of that sort. So in my view, as a Western academic, it's clearly contradictory to the Quran itself. But there are, thousands of these sayings and doings attributed to the Prophet and his companions, which some of them can be picked out and used for polemical purposes.
I mean, that is the point, right? I mean, and that's what we talk about historical context, is that throughout the past 1,500 some odd years, different political entities have wanted to gain the authority of Islam as a mechanism in which to rule or to shape the politics of their day. And so they reinterpret the religion or the document in ways that suit that political agenda.
That's right. And of course, this is a universal phenomenon.
Right. I mean, this is like the kings saying, this is like the king, of England saying, I'm here because God wanted me to be.
Exactly. Or Pope Urban II, who strongly believed that Christians were commanded by the New Testament to go to the Holy Land and slit the throats of the Jews and the Muslims. Religion can be used for these political purposes. And then the whole tradition of the religion can be deployed in various ways. So, in the history of the Holy Roman Empire, after the Roman Empire became Christian, Christianity was the state religion, and gradually no other religion was allowed. The interpretation of the New Testament by the Byzantine kings was that, you know, pagans should be killed. They threw them to the lions. They kind of reversed what had happened to them earlier on. To make this about Christianity as opposed to Byzantine policy would be invidious, it would be unfair, and likewise, a lot of the polemic against Islam is about what Muslims have done in history, which has been both good and bad, you know, as they're human beings.
I mean, ultimately, and lastly, I mean, that obviously, as a historian, this is your field of interest. But what when you set to embark on a project like this, what both from an academic and I guess more from a human perspective do you hope to achieve?
Well, you know, I began this project with an open mind, and I had been trained in my youth in Islamics, and had wanted to go back to it for some time. And, you know, the post 9/11 atmosphere was such that at my blog, I would get involved in conversations with my readers about the Quran and about Islam. And I began to see that it just wasn't well understood. It wasn't understood as I understood it. I also had some puzzles to work through in the text and in the history. So some years ago, I began working on this in what passes for my spare time. And I tried to read as much as I could about the late Roman context of all of these things, and then to trace through these themes in the Quran. Often I was surprised. I was surprised by how much emphasis there was on peacemaking in the Quran, how few, verses there are. It's said that the Prophet Muhammad was involved in these defensive wars for six afternoons in his life, he probably died at 63. So most of it is about community making and peacemaking. And I felt that since the Prophet Muhammad is being demonized so much by Islamophobic forces, both in the United States and Europe now, that a solid explication of his life as it is told by the Quran itself, which I take as my primary source, was really needed.
Has Sam Harris ever reached out to you for, to engage you in your expertise on this subject? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, no. I think Sam thinks he knows it all. He doesn't know Arabic and isn't really, trained in religious studies. So much of what he says, it's just glib polemics. He blames nationalism on religion, his basic argument is that all Muslims are really extremists, or Islam is always extreme, if it isn't, it's because Muslims are living with the blessings of modern enlightened society. And he never talks about, like the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, who were atheists and who killed about a fifth of the country. It's not only Muslims or religious people that have been involved in violence in the 20th century. There's Stalin and so forth. And he seems to say that if only everybody were an atheist, we'd all be living in paradise. And that's clearly not true. Moreover, he blames religious Islam for many things that are actually about things like nationalism.
Well, I'm not necessarily in a position to criticize someone for glib polemics, but I do think that people should reach out if they are going to espouse such opinions to people who are experts. So I appreciate you coming on, Professor Juan Cole. The book is Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. We will put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Sam, and you're the least glib person I've ever met.
Thank you. I appreciate it. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. That was, it's fascinating, and Professor Cole, the research that he has done here extensive, and he's been doing this for decades. So check out that book if you have any interest, and also head over to his blog. It still remains a great source of information, particularly of the Middle East. But broadly speaking, he's a very thoughtful guy, and that's Informed Comment. You can find, I think it is juancole.org. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm and in the podcast description. I apologize for Skype. It has been very strange for the past couple of days. We're actually getting interference from other calls.
People on Reddit have been talking about it as well.
Oh, is that
so
right?
Something's going on.
Yeah.
Waiting for a news story.
Very, very strange. We've noticed that for 2 days now. Hopefully it was not too much of a distraction. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. Every day we try and bring you the best of analysis and news and interviews with in-depth interviews with legitimate scholars in their field.
Thought experiment.
Jamie's writing a piece about podcasts, and am I allowed to say that?
Sure.
She interviewed me by email because I don't like to talk to anybody in the office directly. So all of our exchanges are all by email.
It's a very solitary, quiet, monastic almost workspace.
It's a little bit strange in the office.
The show goes.
The only time that we talk is actually through the microphone. And then when the microphones are off, we just email each other, even if we're in the office. But it's got me... thinking about the various, sort of like podcasts and whatnot. And one of the things in comparing sort of the left podcasts to the right ones in terms of politics, I don't know about in other silos, is that my experience in watching the right-wing shows or podcasts, or at least, you know, sort of peripherally, is that there is a lot of like circular, you know, it's like it's, they all just interview each other. For the most part, there's sometimes they'll bring out, another voice. But like the thrust of it is in talking to other commentators. I imagine there are other shows that are different from that, but I don't know them. I mean, even Ruben's show, it seems like every third show he does is interviewing someone he has interviewed for the 10th time. Like, how many times can that guy from Evergreen State? Whose whole backstory was manufactured anyways. How much insight could this guy have about the world?
I could tell you, researching this book, not much.
Right. But I'm saying, like, you know, they keep bringing on these same commentators over and over again. And I think it's very lucrative. Yes. Because it is like building out a community of sorts, and there's constant reinforcement and there's almost constant corralling of that community. But that just came up in the context of, I don't even know what I was talking about, why you should become a member of the show, because we try and endeavor to bring you voices who actually know what they're talking about. And then we try and spice it up by adding our voices that don't necessarily have the depth of knowledge of some of our guests, but that's where we get our knowledge. What is that guy from Evergreen's? What does he even teach?
What does he teach? I don't remember. I think biology.
Yeah, is it honestly?
Yeah, I think biology.
Yeah, I mean, we have on other commentators too, but we also have on people who are actually doing research out there in the world, which is pretty unique, I think, versus the right.
I have such respect for Juan Cole, and he's formed so much of how I think and look at really important issues. I did find him saying that you were the least glib person he ever met alarming. Because it
that may undercut some of his credibility.
I was disturbed by that as a longtime
reader. But I will say in his defense that Skype has been acting up, and maybe he didn't hear we didn't quite hear him, or he didn't hear us quite clearly. So just a reminder, go to jointhemajorityreport.com, become a member today for just literally a couple of bucks a week, couple quarters a day. A couple of 32-cent pieces a day. Not even that. Nevertheless. Also, Brendan informs me that maybe it was because of Tuesday. I don't know what it was. But the hotcakes sold like hotcakes yesterday. Folks, I think we are we're definitely close to less than a third of tickets left. We're going to sell out. I like to think that we're not going to sell out before Christmas, but I have a feeling that we might. We are doing a live show January 13th at the Bell House as part of the Brooklyn Pod Fest. It is 18 and over, $15 a person. Buy your tickets now, ladies and gentlemen. Buy them now. Don't come crying later, because it's not like we can build on an extension to the Bell House. It is what it is. Fire codes. So you can get your tickets at majority.fm or at Bell House, I imagine, or at the Brooklyn Pod Fest. Also, justcoffee.coop is running a special this month, or for the next, I think, another week and a half. 30% off all your coffee. So check it out, a fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. No coupon code necessary for the next week and a half. Last night, Michael, it was Tuesday. Apparently, there was an enormous amount of drinking going on. The entire liquor cabinet was raided. Presumably there was other things that went on besides the partying last night.
Not much. The title of last night's episode was more like George H.W. Bad. And
was it really?
Yes. It's our most self-indulgent, consciously
it's
lame title we've ever done, but
I sort of like that.
It was a lot of fun. We did the George H.W. Bush drug cartel legacy, and the overlap between drug foreign policy and spikes in prison industrial complex in the United States. Mike Racine, great comic, Dave Rubin's Sam Harris impressions, talked about Fred Hampton, a whole bunch of other stuff, and of course, tickets to our show at the Bell House as well. Patreon.com/TMBS and Michael Brooks Show on YouTube and iTunes. Thanks.
And Jamie?
Out now on the Antifada. Sean and I recap a little bit of our magical Mexican vacation. We talk about why we love visiting Mexico, the legend of Trotsky's cookies, our car breakdown on the side of the road in Chiapas, La Chica Araña's summit with Corbin and AMLO, a visit to Zapatista territory, our run-in with a caravan of internally displaced people, and of course, a psychedelic Tinder love story. Check it out, folks.
Matt is out. Brendan,
this week on Literary Hangover, it's my birthday as Matt Leck, and...
Wait, is today Matt's birthday?
Yeah.
Birthday.
Happy birthday, Matt.
Happy birthday, Matt. He's out. I was going to say he's out partying.
I think he's working on Literary Hangover.
Is he really?
Wow.
Dedicated to his
such
craft.
Hustle.
There you go. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will take your phone calls. And see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
sent us this.
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
And the alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. 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 Back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back. Back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough.